Well, Dag, thank you very much for that wonderful introduction. I'm a bit of a connoisseur of great names, and Dag Roe is a wonderful one. I'm going to file it away. Now, can I order that in a seafood restaurant? I'm honored to speak here today to the joint meeting of the Huntsville Rotary Club and the Greater Huntsville Rotary Club. I have an application in to join the Downtown Rotary Club of Atlanta, and I ask that we pass out some form letters of recommendation to all of you. And if I see you tearing it up, I'll know it's time to finish my speech. I arrived here this morning, and we just visited the Hudson Alpha Institute of Biotechnology, which is more evidence. In fact, they're having, as many of you know, an opening for at least part of the tenants this coming Friday. So it's really right at the beginning of this institute. And it is more evidence that your community here in Huntsville is a center of innovation. Huntsville's unique attributes and, I should say, ongoing prosperity are reminders that in today's world, it's really human capital, brain power, much more than natural resource endowment, that accounts for wealth creation and for economic resilience. And while I'm here over the next 2 days, I plan to visit some businesses and leaders. We're having a business leaders roundtable discussion this afternoon and a dinner tonight at the Art Museum. And I hope to find out a lot more about the vibrant economy of this area. I first came to Huntsville in the 1980s. In fact, I was trying to remember my last visit here, and I estimate it would have been about mid-1986 when I was a banker, as was earlier mentioned, and came here calling on some of your leading corporations. And at that time, I was intrigued by Huntsville's cluster of defense and technology businesses. Before that, growing up in California as a schoolboy, I knew a little bit. I've had vague sense of the story of Wernher von Braun and the rocket scientists who came to Huntsville after World War II. In fact, in the fourth grade, I remember trying to build a to-scale model of a rocket in my backyard using crates to create the assembly of the rocket's body and cardboard to create the nose cone. And my father came out and asked, "What is that?" And it gently suggested that I remove that piece of junk from the premises. And at that point, I concluded that I probably don't have much of a future in rocket science. But in my banking and finance career, I've been exposed to a different breed of rocket scientists. Instead of exploring the frontiers of space, these rocket scientists, or so-called rocket scientists, have pushed the frontiers and the boundaries of finance. And I believe this subject is timely because financial innovations have had a major bearing on economic activity, not just on Wall Street, but also on main streets throughout the United States. This afternoon, I also plan to discuss the current economy. And my remarks, unfortunately, have to carry the disclaimer that some of you have probably heard before, that the views I express are mine alone and not those of my colleagues, or not necessarily those of my colleagues, or the Federal Open Market Committee, or the Federal Reserve, my views alone. Given the importance of defense and the defense industry in Huntsville's economy, I suspect there are a number of people here in the room who have some military background, and perhaps some of you remember the term SITREP. For those not familiar with military jargon, a SITREP, situation report, is a current real-time assessment of conditions and forces on a battlefield. So let me offer a SITREP of our current economy. Recent economic data presents a mixed picture, but basically one of continued strength. The first report of third quarter gross domestic product, GDP growth, was issued last week and had the economy growing at an annual rate of nearly 4%, 3.9% to be exact. And that is a slight increase from strong growth in the second quarter. This year's solid growth has taken place despite widespread and well-publicized weakness in the housing sector. Residential housing weakness is reflected in almost every national statistic, including a 23% year-over-year decline in the sales of new single-family homes in September, and a 30% drop in building permits. So far, evidence of spillover from problems in the housing sector is limited. For instance, personal consumption has held up surprisingly well, and national job market data for October, released after the last FOMC meeting, was encouraging. According to the initial estimate, non-farm payroll employment increased by 166,000 in October, the largest gain since last May. Net exports have also been strong recently, propelled by a combination of strong global demand, strong global economy, and the depreciation of the dollar. In addition to growth, I'm keeping a close watch on prices. And readings of inflation have improved this year, and I believe that inflation will most likely continue to moderate as measured by the so-called core inflation indices. Core inflation indices are those that follow prices according, of course, to some basket or mix, excluding energy prices and food. Now, this has given rise in the past to the joke that central bankers neither drive nor eat. But there are some inflationary risks, in particular, recent increases in energy and commodity prices, among other factors, could put renewed upward pressure on what's called headline inflation, the inflation that you and I encounter in the marketplace. I should add parenthetically that I'm somewhat concerned, at least in terms of the public dialogue we have related to inflation, with the potential divergence between headline inflation that includes gasoline prices and includes food prices and core inflation measures which exclude it. The divergence could confuse the public mind. Despite the positive readings on recent economic performance outside the housing sector, my forecast calls for below-trend, slower GDP growth in the fourth quarter of 2007 and the first half of next year. This forecast anticipates further weakness in housing in the near term and the likelihood that declines in housing wealth will contribute to a weakening of the pace of consumer spending. It should be no surprise that troubles in the financial sector was a topic of discussion at last week's FOMC meeting. At this meeting, you probably recall, the Fed lowered the target for the Fed funds rate 25 basis points to 4.5%. And this move followed a cut of 50 basis points announced after our FOMC meeting of September 18th. The FOMC noted on October 31st that, and I'll quote here, economic growth was solid in the third quarter and that strains in financial markets had eased somewhat. However, the committee expected, again quoting, the pace of economic expansion to slow in the near term, partly reflecting the intensification of the housing corrections. The committee believed its October 31st policy action, combined with its action taken in September, again to quote, should help forestall some of the adverse effects on the broader economy that might otherwise arise from the disruptions in financial markets and promote moderate growth over time. As I laid out a couple of moments ago, my view of the economy is consistent with that FOMC statement, and I supported last week's policy action. In part, my position was based on the notion of insurance against downside risks to the economy, given the unusually high level of uncertainty. I base that assessment on both recent hard data and what I'm hearing from business and financial industry contacts. These contacts provide timely and high texture information that is extremely valuable to me as an FOMC member and to the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta and other reserve banks. And that's true particularly during transitional periods like we're currently experiencing. Some anecdotal information contradicts the picture suggested by the recent data. Recent feedback from our Reserve Bank board members, some of whom are here today, both representing the Atlanta board, head office board, and our Birmingham board, and other boards. Some recent feedback from them and other contacts on the ground throughout the region is somewhat more negative than the numbers suggest. For instance, anecdotally, we hear that attitudes towards future discretionary business investment, capital investment, have grown more cautious since the onset of the financial market turmoil. Now, I attribute that negative sentiment about future capital expenditures more to growing pessimism about economic growth rather than any onset of restrictive credit conditions for Main Street businesses. If I were to use one word to characterize our current economic circumstances, that word would be uncertainty. And much of this uncertainty relates to the potential depth, length, and impact of the housing downturn and the potential flow back to Main Street from turbulence we have seen on Wall Street. Federal Reserve officials ground monetary policy deliberations mostly in the outlook for the general economy, or as we sometimes say, the real economy. In these times, this focus cannot be uncoupled from the concern for the financial sector. That's because credit plays a vital role in fueling virtually all aspects of economic activity. The current level of uncertainty necessarily then has a financial markets dimension. So for the sake of a more complete picture, I'd like to briefly discuss the evolution of our financial system over the last several years, the evolution that brings us to where we are today. When I started my banking career in the 70s, banks were the dominant intermediaries in the credit system. Banks mostly kept exposure on their books, or as we said, on balance sheet. In those days, we spoke of the C's of credit: cash flow, collateral, and very importantly, character. And character reflected the admonition to know your borrower and assess the intangibles of your client. Old timers in those days said, companies don't repay loans, people do. Over the last several decades, we've seen an evolution from a bank-centered financial intermediation system to a market-centered system. As a result, lenders have become investors. Loan spreads have become investment yields. And individual loans have become the feedstock of pools of similar assets brought together through a process known as securitization. These changes have had significant implications for both loan underwriting, both individual and corporate, and also where in the system loans are ultimately held. In terms of underwriting, the old banker looking the borrower in the eye business model has been largely replaced by an originate and distribute business model. Standardization of loan terms has allowed many classes of loans to individuals and businesses to be channeled into marketable securities. The new underwriting model for many types of loans relies on credit scoring and quantifiable measures of the borrower's repayment capacity and the loan's collateral. Loans have become units of statistically modeled pools of assets. In terms of who owns the loans, the holders, the de facto lender, the holders could be anywhere. A Huntsville mortgage, for example, may be held by a local bank, but it could just as easily be held by a New York investment bank, a London hedge fund, an Asian bank, or a Middle Eastern sovereign wealth fund. In the global asset management industry that invests in credit instruments, competition is intense. Small increments of yield can result in performance that differentiates one manager from another. So the incentive to pursue better yield for apparently equivalent risk is very compelling for these investment managers. We all know that in today's world, especially in credit securities markets, there are few, if any, low-risk, high-return investments waiting to be discovered. As a result, many portfolio managers, many investment managers, have sought to boost their returns to their portfolios by using leverage. While this leverage may be obtained in various ways, the end result is similar to an individual investor buying stock on margin or buying an option on a stock. None of this is to imply that banks have become irrelevant to modern finance. They remain important to our system, but the reality is that banks are not as dominant as they once were. In their place has emerged a constellation of asset and investment managers that includes money market funds, hedge funds, and specialized players. We used to call some of these specialized players non-bank banks, an odd term, I thought. Suffice to say, the makeup of today's credit intermediation system is quite complex. Accompanying increased complexity, the market-centered evolution of our credit system has brought many benefits. The innovations of Wall Street's rocket scientists, and normal types as well, have made markets more efficient, deeper, and more liquid. Specifically, financial innovations have provided credit to classes of borrowers who were previously denied access and allowed financial institutions to diversify their often geography-bound risk exposure. Through securitization, risk and yield can now be cut to fit the exacting needs of investors worldwide. Innovations in securitization have turned risky individual exposures that would require high rates of return into diversified pools of loans qualifying for lower rates, with those lower rates at least partially passed back to the individual borrowers. This financial rocket science has been, on balance, positive for society. But predictably, financial innovation and the evolution of the credit system has brought new challenges. As mentioned, today's institutions, portfolios, and securities can be extremely complex. And this complexity is compounded by opacity. Compared to the past, today's system is opaque. Visibility or information is limited in a variety of ways. First, knowing where risk lies in the system is a challenge. Determining the extent of leverage assumed by investors is a challenge. Holders of mortgage-backed and otherwise collateralized securities are challenged to value new instruments that are based upon investment pools or asset pools with little performance history. And liquidity providing market participants often suffer from limited visibility into the risk positions carried by actual and potential counterparties. These are just a few examples of the opaqueness of the system as we currently live it. Clearly, the current circumstances of this new world of financial markets, credit markets, present serious challenges. And then there is the continuing housing sector weakness. So how will this story play out? Let me describe three potential storylines, emphasizing the one I believe represents the most likely scenario for the economy. The first is a very adverse scenario, with housing and financial markets severely affecting real economic activity. In this story, extreme balance sheet pressures cause lending institutions to curtail, to at least some extent, their regular lending to households and businesses, and the dynamic becomes circular, feeding upon itself. A colleague in a recent speech termed this an adverse feedback loop. Let me emphasize that I view this story as being quite unlikely. Another storyline is that the recent developments in financial markets are a mere hiccup, a temporary dislocation of financial markets, followed by a return to normal as defined by conditions and practices that prevailed before the troubles of this summer. I don't view this scenario as realistic. I believe markets, institutions, and risk management practices have been affected profoundly by recent experience. In my view, the most likely storyline is one involving a moderate slowdown in economic activity over the coming quarters, with a return to growth near potential, near trend, by late 2008 as the housing sector begins to recover. Underpinning this story is the view that our modern market economy has a keen ability to self-correct as opportunistic capital moves into depressed markets. Markets do correct, and market solutions are preferable. This transition has already begun to happen in the market for subprime mortgages. In this story, financial markets may endure some weeks or even months more of volatility, but will find a restructured state of normality involving improved risk management practices, reduced leverage, and greater transparency. An appropriate public policy posture is to be supportive of market solutions in the financial markets. Although mostly aimed at the macro economy, I believe the Fed's cumulative 75 basis point reduction of the Fed funds rate target serves this purpose. To conclude, as already explained, I assume my position in March of this year, and no surprise, I've learned firsthand that the job involves intense tracking and discussion of the state and path of the economy. We have near-term uncertainty, but one cannot help being very impressed with the continuing resilience of the U.S. economy. That conclusion isn't rocket science, but it gives comfort as the economy works through our current difficulties. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much.